Broad shoulders and dark, well-sculpted arms stretched against the confines of a faded pink polo shirt. Wrenches and screwdrivers sagged from the pockets of her denim overalls. Against the umber skin of her scalp, her buzz-cut gray hair shimmered like frost. She thrust out her hand. "You probably don't remember me, Lord Apollo. I'm Joe. Or Josie. Or Josephine. Whichever." With each version of her name, she squeezed my hand tighter. I would not have challenged her to an arm wrestling contest. Though with her meaty fingers, I doubt she could play guitar as well as I do, so ha. Her square-jawed face would have been quite intimidating, except for her cheerful, twinkling eyes. Her mouth twitched as if she were exerting a great effort not to bust out laughing. "Yes!" I squeaked, extracting my hand. "I mean, no. I'm afraid I don't remember. May I introduce Leo?"
"Leo!"
She crushed his hand with enthusiasm.
"I'm Joe."
All these people whose names ended in O. Joe, Leo, Calypso, Apollo. Suddenly made me feel like my brand was being diluted. I thanked the gods we were not in Ohio, and our dragon's name was not Festo. "I think I'll call you Josephine," I decided. "It's a lovely name." Josephine shrugged.
"Fine by me. Where's your friend Calypso?"
"Wait," Leo said. "How do you know about Calypso?" Josephine tapped her left temple. "Waystation tells me stuff."
"Oh," Leo's eyes widened. "That's cool."
I wasn't so sure. Normally, when someone said that a building was talking to them, I got away from them as quickly as possible. Sadly, I believed Josephine. I also had the feeling we would be needing her hospitality. "Calypso's in the infirmary," I offered. Broke her hand and foot.
"Ah,"
the sparkle dimmed in Josephine's eyes.
"Yeah, you met the neighbors."
"You mean the Blemii." I imagined the neighbors stopping by to borrow a socket wrench, or take an order for Girl Scout cookies, or murder someone. "Do you often have problems with them?"
"Didn't used to," Josephine sighed. "By themselves, Blemii are pretty harmless, as long as you're polite to them. They don't have enough imagination to organize an assault. But since last year..."
"Let me guess," I said. "Indianapolis has a new emperor?" A ripple of anger washed over Josephine's face, giving me a glimpse of what it would be like to get on her bad side. Hint, it involved pain.
"Best we don't talk about the Emperor until Emmy and your friend join us," she said. "Without Emmy around to keep me calm, I get worked up."
I nodded. Not getting Josephine worked up sounded like an excellent plan. "But we're safe here?" Leo held out his palm as if checking for brick raindrops.
"That was my question, too. I mean, we kind of led an angry mob to your doorstep."
Josephine waved aside our concern.
"Don't worry. The Emperor's forces have been searching for us for months. The way station isn't easy to find unless we invite you in."
"Huh." Leo tapped the floor with his foot. "So, did you design this place? 'Cause it's pretty awesome." Josephine chuckled.
"I wish. A demigod architect with way more talent than me did that. Built the way station back in the 1880s. Early days of the Transcontinental Railroad. It was meant as a refuge for demigods, satyrs, hunters, pretty much anyone who needed one here in the middle of the country. Emmy and I are just lucky enough to be the present caretakers."
"I've never even heard of this place," I said grumpily.
"We keep a low profile. Lady Artemis's orders need no basis. As a god, I was the very definition of need to know. But it was typical of Artemis to keep something like this to herself. She was such a doomsday prepper, always hiding things from the other gods, like stashes of supplies, emergency bunkers, and small nation-states. I assume this place isn't a train station anymore. What do mortals think it is? Josephine grinned. Way station? Transparent floor, please. Beneath our feet, the stained cement disappeared. I leaped back, as if standing on a hot skillet. But the floor was not actually gone. It had simply turned see-through. Around us, the rugs, furniture, and workshop equipment seemed to hover two stories over the actual ground floor of the hall, where 20 or 30 banquet tables had been set up for some sort of event. Our living space occupies the top of the grand hall, Josephine said. That area below us was once the main concourse for the station. Now the mortals rent it out for weddings and parties and whatnot. If they look up, adaptive camouflage, Leo guessed. They see an image of the ceiling, but they don't see you. Nice. Josephine nodded, obviously pleased. Most of the time, it's quiet around here, though it gets noisy on weekends. If I have to hear Thinking Out Loud from one more wedding cover band, I may have to drop an anvil. She pointed to the floor, which immediately turned back to opaque cement. Now, if you guys don't mind, I need to finish a section of a project I'm working on. Don't want the metal plates to cool without proper welding. After that... You're a child of Hephaestus, aren't you? Leo said. Hecate, actually. Leo blinked. No way. But that sweet workshop area you got. Magical construction is my specialty, said Josephine. My dad, my mortal dad, was a mechanic. Nice, Leo said. My mom was a mechanic. Hey, if I could use your machine tools, I left this dragon at the state house and... Ahem, I interrupted. As much as I wanted Festus back, I did not think a nearly indestructible, impossible-to-open suitcase was in any immediate danger. I was also afraid that if Leo and Josephine started chatting, they would soon be bonding over the wonders of serrated flange bolts, and I would die of boredom. Josephine, you were about to say after that... Right, Josephine agreed. Give me a few minutes. Then I can show you to some guest rooms and, maybe get Leo here some clothing. These days we've got plenty of vacancies, unfortunately. I wondered why that was unfortunate. Then I remembered the little girl's empty room we'd passed. Something told me it might be best not to ask about that. We appreciate your help, I told Josephine. But I still don't understand. You say Artemis knows about this place? You and Emmy are, or were, hunters? Josephine's neck muscles tightened against the collar of her pink polo. We were. I frowned. I'd always thought of my sister's followers as a sort of all-maiden mafia. Once you were in, you never left. Unless you left in a lovely silver coffin. But, long story, Josephine cut me off. I probably should let Hemethea tell it.
Hemethea?
The name hit me like one of the way station's bricks. My face felt as if it were slipping down to the center of my chest, Blemmyi style. Suddenly I realized why Emmy had looked familiar. No wonder I'd felt such a sense of unease. Emmy, short for Hemethea. The Hemethea? Josephine glanced from side to side. You really didn't know? She jabbed a finger over her shoulder. So, I'm gonna get back to that welding now. There's food and drinks in the kitchen. Make yourselves at home. She beat a hasty retreat back to her workshop. Dang, Leo muttered. She's awesome. Leo arched his eyebrows. Were you and Hemethea an item back in the day or something? When you heard her name, you looked like somebody kicked you in the crotch. Leo Valdez, in 4,000 years, no one has ever dared to kick me in the crotch. If you mean I looked slightly shocked, that's because I knew Hemethea when she was a young princess in ancient Greece. We were never an item. However, I'm the one who made her immortal. Leo's eyes drifted toward the workshop, where Josephine had begun to weld again. I thought all hunters became immortal once they took the pledge to Artemis. You misunderstand, I said. I made Hemethea immortal before she became a hunter. In fact, I turned her into a god. 5. Tell you a story? Or I could just, like, pass out and twitch on the couch. This was Leo's cue to sit at my feet and listen, enraptured as I told him the story. Instead, he waved vaguely toward the workshop. Yeah, okay. I'm gonna check out the forges. He left me by myself. Demigods today. I blame social media for their short attention spans. When you can't even take the time to listen to a god hold forth, that's just sad. Unfortunately, the story insisted on being remembered. Voices, faces, and emotions from 3,000 years ago flooded my mind, taking control of my senses with such force that I almost crumpled. Over the past few weeks, during our travels west, these waking visions had been happening with alarming frequency. Perhaps they were the result of my faulty human neurons trying to process godly memories. Perhaps Zeus was punishing me with vivid flashbacks of my most spectacular failures. Or perhaps my time as a mortal was simply driving me crazy. Whatever the case, I barely managed to reach the nearest couch before collapsing. I was dimly aware of Leo and Josephine standing at the welding station. Josephine in her welder's gear, and Leo in his boxer shorts, chatting about whatever project Josephine was working on. They didn't seem to notice my distress. Then the memories swallowed me. I found myself hovering above the ancient Mediterranean. Sparkling blue water stretched to the horizon. A warm, salty wind buoyed me up. Directly below, the white cliffs of Naxos rose from the surf like the baleen ridge of a whale's mouth. From a town about 300 yards inland, two teenage girls ran for their lives, making their way toward the edge of the cliff with an armed mob close behind them. The girls' white dresses billowed, and their long, dark hair whipped in the wind. Despite their bare feet, the rocky terrain did not slow them down. Bronzed and lithe, they were clearly used to racing outdoors. But they were running toward a dead end. At the head of the mob, a portly man in red robes screamed and waved the handle of a broken ceramic jar. A gold crown glinted on his brow. Streaks of wine had crusted in his gray beard. His name came to me. Staphylus, King of Naxos. A demigod son of Dionysus, Staphylus had inherited all of his father's worst traits and none of his party dude chill. Now, in a drunken rage, he was yelling something about his daughters breaking his finest amphora of wine, and so naturally they had to die.
"I'll kill you both," he screamed. "I will tear you apart."
I mean, if the girls had broken a Stradivarius violin or gold-plated harmonica, I might have understood his rage. But a jar of wine?
The girls ran on, crying to the gods for help. Normally, this sort of thing would not have been my problem. People cried to the gods for help all the time. They almost never offered anything interesting in return. I probably would have just hovered over the scene, thinking, oh dear, what a shame, ouch, that must have hurt, and then gone about my normal business. This particular day, however, I was not flying over Naxos merely by chance. I was on my way to see the drop-dead gorgeous Rio, the king's eldest daughter, with whom I happened to be in love. Neither of the girls below was Rio. I recognized them as her younger sisters, Parthenos and Hemethia. Nevertheless, I doubted Rio would appreciate it if I failed to help her sisters on my way to our big date. Hey, babe, I just saw your sisters getting chased off a cliff and plummet to their deaths. You want to catch a movie or something? But if I helped her sisters against the wishes of their homicidal father and in front of a crowd of witnesses, that would require divine intervention. There would be forms to fill out, and the three fates would demand everything in triplicate. While I was deliberating, Parthenos and Hemethia charged toward the precipice. They must have realized they had nowhere to go, but they didn't even slow down. Help us, Apollo! Hemethia cried. Our fate rests with you! Then, holding hands, the two sisters leaped into the void. Such a show of faith. It took my breath away. I couldn't very well let them go splat after they'd entrusted me with their lives. Now Hermes? Sure, he might have let them die. He would have found that hilarious. Hermes is a twisted little scamp. But Apollo? No. I had to honor such courage and panache. Parthenos and Hemethia never hit the surface of the water. I stretched out my hands and zapped the girls with a mighty zap, imparting some of my own divine life force into them. Oh, how you should envy those girls. Shimmering and disappearing with a golden flash, filled with tingly warmth and newfound power, they floated upward in a cloud of Tinkerbell-quality glitter. It is no small thing to make someone a god. The general rule is that power trickles down, so any god can theoretically make a new god of lesser power than him or herself. But this requires sacrificing some of one's own divinity, a small amount of what makes you you. So gods don't grant such a favor often. When we do, we usually create only the most minor of gods, as I did with Parthenos and Hemethia. Just the basic immortality package with a few bells and whistles. Although I threw in the extended warranty because I'm a nice guy. Beaming with gratitude, Parthenos and Hemethia flew up to meet me. Thank you, Lord Apollo, Parthenos said. Did Artemis send you? My smile faltered. Artemis? She must have, Hemethia said. As we fell, I prayed, help us, Artemis! No, I said. You cried out, help us, Apollo. The girls looked at each other. No, my lord, said Hemethia. I was sure she had said my name. In retrospect, however, I wondered if I had been assuming rather than listening. The three of us stared at one another. That moment when you turn two girls immortal and then find out they didn't call on you to do so? Awkward. Well, it doesn't matter, Hemethia said cheerfully. We owe you a great debt, and now we are free to follow our heart's desires. I was hoping she would say, to serve Apollo for all eternity and bring him a warm lemon-scented towel before every meal. Instead, Parthenos said, Yes, we will join the hunters of Artemis. Thank you, Apollo. They used their new powers to vaporize, leaving me alone with an angry mob of Naxoans screaming and shaking their fists at the sea. The worst thing? The girl's sister Rio broke up with me like a week later. Over the centuries, I saw Hemethia and Parthenos from time to time in Artemis's retinue. Mostly we avoided each other. Making them minor gods was one of those benevolent mistakes I didn't want to write any songs about. My vision changed, shifting as subtly as the light through the way station's rose window. I found myself in a vast apartment of gold and white marble. Beyond the glass walls and the wraparound terrace, afternoon shadows flooded the skyscraper canyons of Manhattan. I had been here before. No matter where my visions took me, I always seemed to end up back in this nightmarish scene. Reclining on a gilded chaise lounge, the Emperor Nero looked horrifically resplendent in a purple suit, a blue pastel shirt, and pointy alligator leather shoes. On his sizable paunch, he balanced a plate of strawberries, popping them one at a time into his mouth with his little finger raised to show off the 100-carat diamond on his pinky ring. "Meg," he shook his head sadly. "Dear Meg, you should be more excited. This is your chance for redemption, my dear. You won't disappoint me, will you?" His voice was soft and gentle, like a heavy snowfall. The sort that builds up and brings down power lines, collapses roofs, kills entire families. Standing before the Emperor, Meg McCaffrey looked like a wilting plant. Her dark pageboy hair hung listlessly around her face. She slumped in her green t-shirt dress, her knees bent in her yellow leggings, one red high top kicking listlessly at the marble floor. Her face was lowered, but I could see that her cat-eye glasses had been broken since our last encounter. Scotch tape covered the rhinestone tips at either joint. Under the weight of Nero's gaze, she seemed so small and vulnerable. I wanted to rush to her side. I wanted to smash that plate of strawberries into Nero's chinless, neck-bearded excuse for a face. Alas, I could only watch, knowing that this scene had already happened. I had seen it unfold several times in my visions over the last few weeks. Meg didn't speak, but Nero nodded as if she'd answered his question. "Go west," he told her. "Capture Apollo before he can find the next oracle. If you cannot bring him to me alive, kill him." He crooked his diamond-weighted pinky finger. From the line of imperial bodyguards behind him, one stepped forward. Like all Germani, this man was enormous. His muscular arms bulged against his leather cuirass. His brown hair grew wild and long. His rugged face would have been scary even without the serpent tattoo that coiled around his neck and up his right cheek. "This is Vortigern," said Nero. "He will keep you safe." The Emperor tasted the word safe as if it had many possible meanings, none of them good. "You will also travel with another member of the Imperial household, just in case, difficulties arise." Nero curled his pinky again. From the shadows near the stairs appeared a teenage boy, who looked very much like the sort of boy who enjoyed appearing from shadows. His dark hair hung over his eyes. He wore baggy black pants, a black muscle shirt, despite his lack of muscles, and enough gold jewelry around his neck to make him a proper festival idol. At his belt hung three sheathed daggers, two on the right and one on the left. The predatory gleam in his eyes made me suspect those blades were not just for show. In all, the boy reminded me somewhat of Nico D'Angelo, the son of Hades. If Nico were slightly older, more vicious, and had been raised by jackals. "Ah, good, Marcus," Nero said. "Show Meg your destination, will you?" Marcus smiled thinly. He held up his palm, and a glowing image appeared above his fingertips. A bird's-eye view of a city I now recognized as Indianapolis. Nero popped another strawberry in his mouth. He chewed it slowly, letting the juice dribble down his weak chin. I decided that if I ever returned to Camp Half-Blood, I would have to convince Chiron to change their cash crop to blueberries.
Meg, my dear, Nero said,
I want you to succeed.
Please don't fail. If the beast becomes cross with you again, he shrugged helplessly. His voice ached with sincerity and concern. I just don't know how I could protect you. Find Apollo. Subject him to your will. I know you can do this. And my dear, do be careful in the court of our friend, the new Hercules. He is not as much a gentleman as I. Don't get caught up in his obsession with destroying the House of Nets. That's a mere sideshow. Succeed quickly and come back to me.
Nero spread his arms.
Then we can be one happy family again.
The boy Marcus opened his mouth, perhaps to make a snide comment, but when he spoke, it was Leo Valdez's voice shattering the vision.
Apollo! I gasped.
I was back in the way station, sprawled across the couch. Standing over me, frowning with concern, were our hosts, Josephine and Emmy, along with Leo and Calypso.
I had a dream.
I pointed weakly at Emmy.
And you were there. And the rest of you. Not so much, but...
A dream?
Leo shook his head. He was now dressed in a pair of grimy overalls.
Man, your eyes were wide open. You were lying there all twitching and stuff.
I've seen you have some visions before, but not like that.
I realized my arms were shaking. I grabbed my right hand with my left, but that only made it worse.
I heard some new details, or things I didn't remember from before, about Meg, and the Emperors, and...
Josephine patted my head as if I were a cocker spaniel.
You sure you're okay there, Sonny? You don't look so hot.
There was a time when I would have deep-fried anyone who called me Sonny. After I took over the reins of the Sun Chariot from the old Titan god Helios, Ares had called me Sonny for centuries. It was one of the few jokes he understood. At least one of the few clean jokes.
I'm fine, I snapped. Well, what's going on? Calypso, you're already healed?
You've been out for hours, actually. She raised her recently broken hand, which now looked as good as new, and wriggled her fingers. But yes, Emmy is a healer to rival Apollo.
You had to say that, I grumbled. You mean I've been lying here for hours and nobody noticed?
Leo shrugged.
We were kind of busy talking shop. We probably wouldn't have noticed you as soon as we did, except, somebody here wants to talk to you.
Calypso agreed, a worried look in her eyes. He's been very insistent about it. She pointed toward the rose window. At first, I thought I was seeing orange spots. Then I realized an apparition was floating toward me. Our friend Agamethus, the headless ghost, had returned. 6. Oh, magic 8-ball. Epic fail at prophecies. Leo's ears on fire. The ghost drifted toward us. His mood was difficult to discern since he had no face, but he seemed agitated. He pointed at me, then made a series of hand gestures I didn't understand.
shaking his fists, lacing his fingers, cupping one hand as if holding a sphere. He stopped on the opposite side of the coffee table. "Sup, cheese?" Leo asked. Josephine snorted. "Cheese." "Yeah, he's orange," Leo said. "Why is that? Also, why is he headless?"
"Leo," Calypso chided, "don't be rude."
"Hey, it's a fair question."
Emmy studied the ghost's hand gestures. "I've never seen him this worked up. He glows orange because... well, actually, I have no idea. As for why he is headless..."
"His brother cut off his head," I supplied.
The memory surfaced from the dark stew of my mortal brain, though I did not recall the details. "Agamethus was the brother of Trophonius, the spirit of the Dark Oracle. He... there was something else. Something that filled me with guilt, but I couldn't remember."
The others stared at me.
"His brother did what?"
Calypso asked.
"How did you know that?" Emmy demanded.
I had no answer. I was not sure myself where the information had come from.
But the ghost pointed at me as if to say, "This dude knows what's up." Or possibly more disturbingly, "It's your fault."
Then he again made the gesture of holding a sphere.
"He wants the magic eight ball," Josephine interpreted. "I'll be right back."
She jogged over to her workshop.
"The magic eight ball?"
Leo grinned at Emmy. The name tag on his borrowed overalls read Georgie.
"She's kidding, right?"
"She's dead serious," Emmy said.
So to speak.
"We might as well sit." Calypso and Emmy took the armchairs. Leo hopped onto the couch next to me, bouncing up and down with such enthusiasm I had an annoying pang of nostalgia for Meg McCaffrey. As we waited for Josephine, I tried to dredge my memory for more specifics about this ghost, Agamethus. Why would his brother Trophonius have decapitated him? And why did I feel so guilty about it? But I had no success. Just a vague sense of unease, and the feeling that, despite his lack of eyes, Agamethus was glaring at me. Finally, Josie trotted back over. In one hand, she gripped a black plastic sphere the size of a honeydew melon. On one side, painted in the middle of a white circle, was the number 8.
"I love those things," Leo said. "Haven't seen one in years."
I scowled at the sphere, wondering if it was some sort of bomb. That would explain Leo's excitement.
"What does it do?"
"Are you kidding?" asked Leo.
"It's a magic eight ball, man. You ask it questions about the future."
"Impossible," I said. "I am the god of prophecy. I know every form of divination, and I have never heard of a magic eight ball."
Calypso leaned forward.
"I'm not familiar with this form of sorcery either. How does it work?"
Josephine beamed.
"Well, it's supposed to be just a toy. You shake it, turn it over, and an answer floats up in this little plastic window on the bottom. I made some modifications. Sometimes the magic eight ball picks up on Agamethus' thoughts and conveys them in writing."
"Sometimes?" Leo asked.
Josephine shrugged. "Like 30% of the time. Best I could manage."
I still had no idea what she was talking about.
The magic eight ball struck me as a very shady form of divination. More like a Hermes game of chance than an oracle worthy of me.
"Wouldn't it be faster if Agamethus simply wrote down what he wanted to say?" I asked.
Emmy shot me a warning look.
"Agamethus is illiterate. He's a little sensitive about that."
The ghost turned toward me. His aura darkened to the color of a blood orange.
"Ah," I said, And those hand gestures he was making?
It's no form of sign language that we can figure out, Joe said. We've been trying for 7 years, ever since Agamethus joined us. The magic eight ball is the best form of communication we've got. Here, buddy.
She tossed him the magical sphere.
Since Agamethus was ethereal, I expected the ball to sail right through him and shatter on the floor.
Instead, Agamethus caught it easily.
Okay, Josephine said. So, Agamethus, what do you want to tell us?
The ghost shook the magic eight ball vigorously and then threw it to me.
I was not prepared for the sphere to be full of liquid, which, as any water bottle flipper can tell you, makes an object much more difficult to control. It hit my chest and dropped into my lap. I barely caught it before it wobbled off the couch.
Master of dexterity, Calypso muttered.
Turn it over.
Weren't you listening?
Oh, be quiet.
I wished Calypso could only communicate 30% of the time. I rotated the ball bottom up. As Josephine had described, a layer of clear plastic was set in the base of the sphere, providing a window to the liquid inside. A large, white, multi-sided die floated into view. I knew this thing smacked of Hermes's wretched gambling games. One side of it pressed against the window, revealing a sentence written in block letters. "Apollo must bring her home," I read aloud. I looked up. Emmy's and Josephine's faces had become twin masks of shock. Calypso and Leo exchanged a wary glance. Leo started to say, what? Simultaneously, Emmy and Josephine unleashed a torrent of questions. Is she alive? Is she safe? Where is she? Tell me. Emmy shot to her feet. She began to pace, sobbing in great dry heaves, while Josephine advanced on me, her fists clenched, her gaze as sharp as the pointed flame of her welding torch.
I don't know.
I tossed Josephine the ball as if it were a hot baklava.
Don't kill me.
She caught the magic eight ball, then seemed to check herself. She took a heavy breath.
Sorry, Apollo.
Sorry.
I...
She turned to Agamethus.
Here. Answer us. Tell us.
She threw him the ball. Agamethus seemed to regard the magical sphere with his non-existent eyes. His shoulders slumped as if he did not relish his job. He shook the ball once again and tossed it back to me.
Why me?
I protested.
Read it,
Emmy snapped. I turned it over. A new message appeared out of the liquid. Reply hazy, I read aloud. Try again later. Emmy wailed in despair. She sank into her seat and buried her face in her hands. Josephine rushed to her side. Leo frowned at the ghost.
Yo, cheese, just shake it again, man.
It's no use, Josephine said. When the magic eight ball says try again later, that's exactly what it means. We'll have to wait. She sat on the arm of Emmy's chair and cradled Emmy's head against her.
It's all right, Josie murmured. We'll find her. We'll get her back.
Hesitantly, Calypso stretched out her palm, as if she weren't sure how to help.
I'm so sorry. Who is missing?
With a quivering lip, Josephine pointed to Leo. Leo blinked.
I'm still here.
Not you, Josephine said. The name tag. Those overalls. They were hers. Leo patted the stitched name on his chest.
Georgie?
Emmy nodded, her eyes puffy and red. Georgina, our adopted daughter. I was glad I was sitting down. Suddenly, so many things made sense that they overwhelmed me like another vision. The two aging hunters who were not hunters. The child's empty bedroom. The crayon drawings done by a little girl. Josephine had mentioned that Agamethus arrived in their lives approximately 7 years ago.
You two left the hunters, I said. For each other.
Josephine gazed into the distance, as if the building's walls were as transparent as the magic eight ball's base.
We didn't exactly plan it. We left in, what, 1986?
87,
Emmy said.
We've been aging together ever since. Very happily.
She wiped away a tear, not looking terribly happy at the moment. Calypso flexed her recently broken hand.
I don't know much about Lady Artemis or her rules for followers.
That's fine, Leo interrupted. Calypso glared at him.
But don't they forswear the company of men? If you two fell in love...
No, I said bitterly. All romance is off limits. My sister is quite unreasonable in that regard. The mission of the hunters is to live without romantic distractions of any kind. Thinking about my sister and her anti-romantic ideas irritated me. How could two siblings be so different? But I was also irritated with Hemethea. She had not only given up being a hunter, in doing so she had also given up the divinity I had granted her.
Just like a human.
We give you immortality and godly power, then you trade it in for love and a loft in downtown Indianapolis.
The nerve!
Emmy wouldn't meet my eyes. She sighed wistfully.
We delighted in being hunters, both of us. They were our family, but...
She shrugged. We loved each other more, Josephine supplied. I got the feeling they finished each other's sentences a lot. Their thoughts were in such comfortable harmony. That did not help my irritation levels. You must have parted with Artemis on good terms, I said.
She let you live.
Josephine nodded. The ladies' hunters often stop here at the way station, though we have not seen Artemis herself in decades. Then 7 years ago, we were blessed with Georgina. She was brought to our door by Agamethus. The orange ghost bowed.
He brought her from where? I wondered.
Emmy spread her hands.
We've never been able to get that information from him. It's the one question the Magic Eight Ball never answers.
Leo must have been thinking deeply. A tuft of fire broke out at the top of his left ear. Hold up. Agamethus isn't your kid's dad, is he? Also, you're telling me I'm wearing the overalls of a 7-year-old girl and they fit? That got a broken laugh from Josephine. I suppose they do. And no, Leo, Agamethus is not Georgina's father. Our ghostly friend has been dead since ancient times. Like Apollo said, he was the brother of Trophonius, the spirit of the oracle. Agamethus appeared here with baby Georgie. Then he led us to the oracle. That was the first we knew of its existence. So you have its location, I said.
Of course, Emmy murmured. For all the good it does us.
Too many questions crowded in my head. I wanted to divide myself into a dozen different manifestations so I could pursue every answer at once. But alas, mortals don't split easily. But the girl and the oracle must be connected somehow. Emmy closed her eyes. I could tell she was trying hard to suppress a sob. We didn't realize how closely they were connected.
not until Georgie was taken from us.
The Emperor, I guessed. Josephine nodded. I hadn't even met this second member of the Triumvirate yet, and I already hated him. I had lost Meg McCaffrey to Nero. I did not like the idea of another young girl being taken by another evil emperor. In my vision, I recalled, I heard Nero call this emperor the new Hercules. Who is he? What did he do with Georgina? Emmy rose unsteadily to her feet.
I need to do something productive with my hands. It's the only way I've stayed sane the past 2 weeks. Why don't you all help us make lunch? Then we'll talk about the monster who controls our city.
7. I chopped those onions with my own ex-godly hands. You'd better eat them. Being productive. Ugh. It's such a human concept. It implies that you have limited time, LOL, and have to work hard to make something happen. Double LOL. I mean, perhaps if you were laboring away for years writing an opera about the glories of Apollo, I could understand the appeal of being productive. But how can you get a sense of satisfaction and serenity from preparing food? That I did not understand. Even at Camp Half-Blood, I wasn't asked to make my own meals. True, the hot dogs were questionable, and I never found out what sort of bugs were in bug juice, but at least I'd been served by a cadre of beautiful nymphs. Now I was compelled to wash lettuce, dice tomatoes, and chop onions. Where does this food come from? I asked, blinking tears from my eyes. I'm no Demeter, but even I could tell this produce was fresh from the earth. Probably because of the amount of dirt I had to wash off. The thought of Demeter made me think of Meg, which might have caused me to weep, even if I hadn't already been afflicted by onion fumes. Calypso dumped a basket of muddy carrots in front of me. Emmy's got a garden on the roof. Greenhouses. Year-round growing. You should see the herbs. Basil, thyme, rosemary. It's amazing. Emmy smiled. Thank you, dear. You definitely know your gardening. I sighed. Now those two were bonding. Soon I would be stuck between Emmy and Calypso discussing kale-growing techniques, and Leo and Josephine waxing poetic about carburetors. I couldn't win. Speak of the diamond. Leo burst through the door next to the pantry, holding aloft a wheel of cheese like a victor's laurel crown.
Behold the cheddar, he announced. All hail the cheese conquerors!
Josephine, chuckling good-naturedly, lumbered in behind him with a metal pail.
The cows seemed to like Leo.
Hey, abuelita, Leo said.
All the cows love Leo.
He grinned at me.
And these cows are red, man, like bright red.
That definitely made me want to weep. Red cows were my favorite. For centuries, I had a herd of sacred scarlet cattle before cow collecting went out of fashion. Josephine must have seen the miserable look on my face.
We just use their milk, she said hastily. We don't butcher them.
I should hope not, I cried. Killing red cattle would be sacrilege. Josephine didn't look properly terrified by the idea.
Yeah, but mostly it's because Emmy made me give up meat 20 years ago.
It's much better for you, Emmy chided. You're not immortal anymore, and you need to take care of yourself.
But cheeseburgers, Joe muttered.
Leo plunked the cheese wheel in front of me.
Cut me a wedge of this, my good man. Chop, chop.
I scowled at him.
Don't test me, Valdez. When I am a god again, I will make a constellation out of you. I will call it the Small Exploding Latino.
I like it.
He patted my shoulder, causing my knife to jiggle.
Did no one fear the wrath of the gods anymore?
While Emmy baked loaves of bread, which I must admit smelled incredible, I tossed a salad with carrots, cucumbers, mushrooms, tomatoes, and all manner of roof-grown plant material. Calypso used fresh lemons and cane sugar to make lemonade, while humming tracks from Beyoncé's album of the same name. During our travels west, I had taken it upon myself to catch Calypso up on the last 3 millennia of popular music. Leo cut the cheese. You can interpret that any way you want. The cheddar wheel turned out to be bright red all the way through, and quite tasty. Josephine made dessert, which she said was her specialty. Today, this meant fresh berries and homemade sponge cake in sweet red cream, with a meringue topping lightly toasted with a welding torch. As for the ghost Agamethus, he hovered in one corner of the kitchen, holding his magic eight ball dejectedly, as if it were a third-place prize from a 3-person competition. Finally, we sat down to lunch. I hadn't realized how hungry I was. It had been quite a while since breakfast, and Festus's in-flight meal service left much to be desired. I shoveled my food in while Leo and Calypso told our hosts about our travels west. Between bites of fresh bread with bright red butter, I added commentary as needed, since, of course, I had the superior storytelling skills. We explained how my ancient foe Python had retaken the original site of Delphi, cutting off access to the most powerful oracle. We explained how the Triumvirate had sabotaged all forms of communication used by demigods. Iris messages, magical scrolls, ventriloquist puppets, even the arcane magic of email. With the help of Python, the 3 evil emperors now intended to control or destroy all the oracles from ancient times, thus putting the very future of the world in a stranglehold. "We freed the Grove of Dodona," I summed up. "But that oracle simply sent us here to secure the next source of prophecy, the Cave of Trophonius." Calypso pointed to my quiver, which lay against the nearest sofa. "Apollo, show them your talking arrow." Emmy's eyes gleamed with the keen interest of an archer.
"Talking arrow?"
I shuddered. The arrow I had retrieved from the whispering trees of Dodona had so far done me little good. Only I could hear its voice, and whenever I asked its advice, it spouted nonsense in Elizabethan English, which infected my speech patterns and left me talking like a bad Shakespearean actor for hours. This amused Calypso to no end. "I will not show them my talking arrow," I said. "I will, however, share the limerick." "No," said Calypso and Leo in unison. They dropped their forks and covered their ears. I recited. "There once was a god named Apollo, who plunged in a cave, blue and hollow. Upon a 3-seater, the bronze fire-eater was forced death and madness to swallow." Around the table, an uncomfortable silence fell. Josephine glowered. "Never before has any voice dared to utter a limerick in this house, Apollo."
"And let us hope no one will ever do so again," I agreed. "But such was the prophecy of Dodona that brought us here."
Emmy's expression tightened, removing any lingering doubts that this was the same Hemethia I had immortalized so many centuries ago. I recognized the intensity in her eyes, the same determination that had sent her over a cliff, trusting her fate to the gods. "A cave blue and hollow," she said. "That's the Oracle of Trophonius, all right. It's located in the Blue Spring Caverns, about 80 miles south of town." Leo grinned as he chewed, his mouth an avalanche of earth-toned food particles.
"Easiest quest ever, then. We get Festus back, then we look up this place on Google Maps and fly down there."
Doubtful, Josephine said. The Emperor has the surrounding countryside heavily guarded. You couldn't fly a dragon anywhere near Blue Spring without getting shot out of the sky. Even if you could, the cave entrances are all way too small for a dragon to plunge into. Leo pouted. But the limerick. Maybe deceptive, I said. It is, after all, a limerick. Calypso sat forward. She had wrapped a napkin around her formerly broken hand, perhaps because it still ached, perhaps because she was nervous. It reminded me of torch wadding. Not a happy association after my last encounter with the mad Emperor Nero. What about the last line? She asked. Apollo will be forced death and madness to swallow. Josephine stared at her empty plate. Emmy gave her hand a quick squeeze. The Oracle of Trophonius is dangerous, Emmy said. Even when we had free access to it before the Emperor moved in, we would only consult the spirit in extreme emergencies. She turned to me. You must remember, you were the god of prophecy. Despite the excellent lemonade, my throat felt parched. I didn't like being reminded of what I used to be. I also didn't like the gigantic holes in my memory, filled with nothing but vague dread. I remember the cave was dangerous, yes, I said. I don't recall why. You don't recall? Emmy's voice took on a dangerous edge. I normally concentrated on the godly side of things, I said. The quality of the sacrifices, what sort of incense the petitioners burned, how pleasing the hymns of praise were. I never asked what kind of trials the petitioners went through. You never asked. I didn't like Emmy echoing my words. I had a feeling she would make an even worse Greek chorus than Calypso. I did some reading at Camp Half-Blood, I said defensively. There wasn't much about Trophonius. Chiron couldn't help either. He'd completely forgotten about the Oracle. Supposedly, Trophonius's prophecies were dark and scary. Sometimes they drove people insane. Perhaps his cave was a sort of haunted house? With, dangling skeletons, priestesses jumping out and saying boo? Emmy's sour expression told me that my guess was off the mark. I also read something about petitioners drinking from two special springs, I persisted. I thought swallowing death and madness might be a symbolic reference to that. You know, poetic license. No, Josephine muttered. It's not poetic license. That cave literally drove our daughter mad. A cold draft swept across my neck, as if the way station itself had let out a forlorn sigh. I thought about the apocalypse I'd seen crayoned on the wall of the child's now abandoned bedroom. What happened? I asked, though I wasn't sure I wanted to know, especially if it might be a portent of what I would soon face. Emmy tore a piece of bread crust. She let the pieces fall. Once the Emperor came to Indianapolis, this new Hercules. Calypso started to ask a question, but Emmy raised a hand. Please, dear, don't ask me to name him. Not here. Not now. As I'm sure you know, many gods and monsters hear you when you speak their names. He is worse than most. A pang of sympathy pulled at the corner of Calypso's mouth. Please, go on. At first, Emmy said, we didn't understand what was happening. Our friends and companions began to disappear. She gestured around her at the vast living area. We used to have a dozen or so living here at any given time. Now, we're all that's left. Josephine leaned back in her chair. In the light of the rose window, her hair gleamed the same steel gray as the wrenches in her coverall pockets.
The Emperor was looking for us. He knew about the way station. He wanted to destroy us. But like I said, this isn't an easy place to find unless we invite you in.
So instead, his forces waited until our people were outside. They took our friends a few at a time. Took them? I asked. As in alive?
Oh, yeah.
Josephine's grim tone made it sound as if death would have been preferable.
The Emperor loves prisoners. He captured our guests, our griffins.
A berry slipped out of Leo's fingers.
Griffins?
Hazel and Frank told me about griffins. They fought some in Alaska. Said they were like rabid hyenas with wings. Josephine smirked. The small ones, the wild ones, can be, yeah. But we raise the best here.
At least, we did.
Our last mating pair disappeared about a month ago. Heloise and Abelard. We let them out to hunt. They have to do that to stay healthy. They never returned. For Georgina, that was the final insult. A bad feeling began to nag at me. Something beyond the obvious, we're talking about creepy things that might get me killed. The griffin nests in the niches above us. A distant memory about my sister's followers. A comment Nero had made in my vision. That the new Hercules was obsessed with destroying the House of Nets. As if that were another name for the way station. I felt like someone's shadow was falling over the dining table. Someone I should know. Perhaps someone I should be running away from. Calypso unwrapped the napkin from her hand. Your daughter, she asked. What happened to her? Neither Josephine nor Emmy responded. Agamethus bowed slightly, his bloody tunic glowing in various shades of nacho topping. It's obvious, I said into the silence. The girl went to the cave of Trophonius. Emmy looked past me to Agamethus, her eyes as sharp as arrow points. Georgina got it into her head that the only way to save the way station and find the captives was to consult the Oracle. She'd always been drawn to the place. She didn't fear it the way most people did. One night she slipped away. Agamethus helped her. We don't know exactly how they got there. The ghost shook his magic eight ball. He tossed it to Emmy, who frowned at the answer on the bottom. It was ordained, she read. I don't know what you mean, you old dead fool, but she was just a child. Without the throne, you knew what would happen to her. The throne? Calypso asked. Another memory bobbed to the surface of my eight-ball brain. Oh, gods, I said. The throne. Before I could say more, the entire hall shuddered. Plates and cups rattled on the dining table. Agamethus vanished in a flash of nacho orange. At the top of the barreled ceiling, the green and brown stained glass panels darkened, as if a cloud had blacked out the sun. Josephine rose. Waystation, what's happening on the roof? As far as I could tell, the building didn't respond. No brick shot out of the wall. No doors banged open and shut in Morse code. Emmy set the magic eight ball on the table. The rest of you stay here. Joe and I will check it out. Calypso frowned. But That's an order, Emmy said. I'm not losing any more guests.
It can't be come... Josephine stopped herself. It can't be him.
Maybe Heloise and Abelard are back.
Maybe. Emmy didn't sound convinced. But just in case.
The two women moved quickly to a metal supply cabinet in the kitchen. Emmy grabbed her bow and quiver. Josephine pulled out an old-fashioned machine gun with a circular drum magazine between the two handles. Leo nearly choked on his dessert.
Is that a Tommy gun?
Josephine patted the weapon affectionately.
This is little Bertha. A reminder of my sordid past life. I'm sure there's nothing to worry about. You all sit tight.
With that comforting advice, our heavily armed hosts marched off to check the roof. 8. Lovebirds arguing. Trouble in Elysium? I'll just scrub these plates. The order to sit tight seemed clear enough to me. Leo and Calypso, however, decided that the least we could do was clean up the lunch dishes. See my previous comment, the dumbness of productivity. I scrubbed, Calypso rinsed, Leo dried, which wasn't even work for him since all he had to do was heat his hands a little. So, Calypso said, what's this throne Emmy mentioned? I scowled at my foamy stack of bread pans. The throne of memory. It's a chair carved by the goddess Mnemosyne herself. Leo leered at me over the top of a steaming salad plate.
You forgot the throne of memory? Isn't that a mortal sin or something?
The only mortal sin, I said, would be failing to incinerate you as soon as I become a god again.
You could try, Leo said,
but then how would you learn those secret scales on the Valdezonator?
I accidentally sprayed myself in the face.
What secret scales?
Both of you stop, Calypso ordered. Apollo, why is this throne of memory important? I wiped the water off my face. Talking about the throne of memory had jogged loose a few more pieces of information from my mind, but I didn't like what I'd remembered. Before a petitioner went into the cave of Trophonius, I said, he or she was supposed to drink from two magical springs, forgetfulness and memory. Leo picked up another plate. Steam curled from the porcelain.
Wouldn't the two springs, like, cancel each other out?
I shook my head. Assuming the experience didn't kill you, it would prepare your mind for the oracle. You would then descend into the cave and experience untold horrors.
Such as,